Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, March 2nd. Who profits when people get put away? Every Tuesday evening through May 4th, the Green Space, in partnership with the advocacy group Worth Rises, is holding a virtual panel discussion about one aspect of the business side of the prison industry, and we are having a segment previewing those weekly discussions on Mondays or Tuesdays here on The Brian Lehrer Show. We've talked about prison architecture in this series, and design, and companies that contract to fill vacancies and make training videos among correctional staff. And today, we're going to talk about prison labor. Prison labor has been a part of the U.S. economy since at least the late 19th century. Today, incarcerated people do everything from agriculture to janitorial work to building office furniture, making hand sanitizer, staffing call centers, and doing 3D modeling. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. But the average wage for an incarcerated worker is 30 to 60 cents an hour. There are five states that do not pay incarcerated workers at all. And part of the reason states can pay little to nothing for labor is because of language in the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Yes, the one that outlawed slavery and involuntary servitude, but it had a loophole. The 13th Amendment says, quote, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, unquote. That language has come to be known as the slavery loophole among critics who say slave labor is continuing inside our correctional institutions. My next guest is Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley. He's one of the Democrats in the U.S. Senate leading the effort to amend the Constitution to get rid of the so-called slavery loophole with a joint resolution known as the Abolition Amendment. Senator, it's so nice to have you on New York Public Radio. Welcome to our program.
Oh, thank you so much, Brian. Wonderful to be with you.
Why did the authors of the 13th Amendment include the so-called loophole language in the first place?
Well, it's a good question. The record is incomplete, but certainly a significant amount of lobbying, primarily from Southern Democrats, that this would be a fair way to go forward is to allow slavery to continue for those who were convicted of a crime. I think very few really recognized at the moment that this would instantly produce laws that essentially became known as the Black Codes. They happened almost immediately thereafter, after the 13th Amendment was passed, in which it became a crime to be black. And by that, I mean you could be arrested for the way you walked on a sidewalk, for speaking too loudly, for loitering, for being on a street after dark. In other words, you could be arrested and convicted for any reason, enabling the state to essentially say, hey, we've got the power to continue slavery simply by arresting people for being black and then running them back into the slave economy. And that's exactly what happened. And it continued all of the horrific effects of slavery. Fathers, mothers ripped away from their family, destroying the families, destroying the finances of the family. Even children were sometimes rented back into slavery. So it's a very, very dark history, a history that eventually helped create the mass incarceration, helped deprive black Americans of political power by taking away their right to vote, which was also a power of incarcerating someone. It helped drive the process that led to Jim Crow. And so we see this reverberating through the ages as a deep injustice that continued after adoption of the 13th Amendment.
So the language in your amendment says work programs and training opportunities for incarcerated individuals could continue, but not without consent. Can you talk about that distinction, with or without consent?
Yes, that's not the language. That is the description of the impact. It's not what the actual language would strike the slavery clause out of the 13th Amendment. And but people say, well, what does that mean? Can work programs continue? Yes, they can continue. Oregon's work programs currently are voluntary. Oregon Corrections proceeds to say they totally support this. Realize that there are some 20 states that also have this slavery clause in their state constitutions, and some have started to take it out. Nebraska has taken it out. Utah has taken it out. So we're talking red states that have taken it out. Colorado has taken it out, more of a purple to blue state. Oregon is considering taking it out this very year, and I certainly hope they will. It'll be a referral out to the constitutional referral out to the voters, and so you essentially say some states though do use private prisons that continue to use involuntary renting of people back to basically make money for the corporation or for the state. And so there is still significant exploitation, with some estimated 900,000 Americans are being rented out by the prison industry. And recognize this, that this process of profiting off the renting out of prisoners helps drive mass incarceration, because the prison industry benefits from the profits from running people out. So then they lobby for three strike laws and get tough on crime laws in order to get more people in prison, which always ends up bearing disproportionately on communities of color in the United States.
Now, skeptics might point out that modern prison labor doesn't actually draw its authority directly from the 13th Amendment. So in these states that have done away with the similar clauses in their state constitutions, has there been any functional change in those states regarding prison labor?
Good question. And we don't have an analysis yet. It's very new for the three states to have struck down this clause. But my understanding is those states, they are continuing with voluntary work programs. Now, work programs are highly beneficial, and this isn't to do away with work programs. But there, if you are in a, you are being assigned to a work program that is horrific, you could, as a prisoner, say, no, I'm not going to do that. Well, then that's that puts a check on unsafe practices. You're being exposed to terrible chemicals. You're exposed to hazards because safe and healthy practices aren't required in these settings. So it gives some balance to that equation. But most prisoners like the idea of participating because it makes the day shorter, gives them structure to their lives, allows them to get outside of their cell, allows them to develop training that may be useful when they're out of prison to be able to get a job. So retains all those healthy aspects in these states that have obliterated their slavery clause.
And although prison labor stems from the racist ashes of convict leasing, as you were describing before, the more modern defense of the practice says, as you were alluding to, that work gives incarcerated people purpose in many cases. And I gather there is a 1979 law which allows some private companies to hire prisoners but requires them to pay a prevailing wage. So I wonder if there are positive models for prison labor happening right now in the United States that you endorse.
I think the idea of being able to be paid a significant wage, enabling prisoners to prepare for the transition out of prison, makes some significant sense. And I'm looking forward to having hearings in which we explore those positive models. One of the big challenges that drives reincarceration and basically recidivation, that is people committing crimes again when they leave prison, is they have no resources. They've lost their connections to friends and family. And they have no ability to have the money to buy rent an apartment or buy their groceries. And so being able to build up some savings before you leave prison might greatly facilitate success in leaving prison, which is good for everyone. You don't want to encourage a situation where people feel like their last resort is committing another crime. That hurts everyone.
You mentioned before lack of occupational safety and health protections for prison laborers. And I didn't know that until I was reading in on your amendment. And that's shocking to me because I gather the IRS says inmate laborers are not employees. And so therefore, the Occupational Safety and Health Act and the administration of the agency called OSHA in the federal government, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, their standards don't protect prison laborers. Do I have that right? And is that absolute?
Yes, you have that right.
That's shocking. Would your amendment correct that, or would that take a separate law?
It certainly would give some leverage. It isn't clear that it would modify that directly, but it enables prisoners who are being exposed, say they're being exposed to asbestos, which amazingly is still used in American production, or to other chemicals without a proper mask to prevent your contamination, or some other thing that the prisoner says, no, this is really a bad idea. I shouldn't be in this situation. This is going to destroy my health. They'd have the ability to push back and say, I'm sorry, unless we improve these working conditions, I'm not accepting this work.
So how realistic?
And I should note that in some...
Go ahead.
I should note that in some cases, I'm sure that people are entering into jobs where they're being essentially rented out to companies that are providing the same work conditions that they have for other employees. So it's not that every job is dangerous. It's just there is no protection for a prisoner from a dangerous situation.
We just have a couple of minutes left with U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon, one of the Democrats leading the effort to amend the Constitution to get rid of the so-called slavery loophole in the 13th Amendment with a joint resolution known as the Abolition Amendment. So, Senator, how realistic is it that this amendment could get passed? I think it takes, let's see, tell me if I've got my civics right, 2/3 of a majority of both the House and the Senate, followed by 3/4 of the states to ratify a constitutional amendment?
It's exactly right, and it's very rare. But what I'm encouraged by is we're at the start of an important conversation, a conversation that has involved Republican states like Nebraska, like Utah. Other states are starting to go, oh, my goodness, we didn't realize we had this in our Constitution. So there'll be a series of state discussions that will help pave the path for it. We will have results from those states, which we can take to the federal conversation and say, your fear was that XYZ. Those fears did not happen when states changed this law. It's making these work programs better, stronger, more significant, health and safety protected, helping prisoners develop some savings for success when they leave prison. The effects have all been positive. We need to develop that record in order to be able to have a conversation that has some chance of getting two-thirds of the House and Senate, and then 3/4 of the states. So we're at the beginning of that, but recognize this. We just had a year in which we talked a lot about systemic racism. Here we have a hugely powerful clause in the Constitution that has driven systemic racism from the end of the Civil War forward. And remember, as I pointed out, it's one of the factors that is driving mass incarceration because of the private prison industry still profiting from renting out prisoners. So changing this is not symbolic. It will have real effects, real positive effects. And in this national conversation about systemic racism, wouldn't it be great to eliminate this glaring, atrocious slavery clause out of the 13th Amendment?
Senator Merkley, we really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for coming on with us and sharing this.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you, Brian.
And we're going to continue this for a few more minutes with your phone calls and with Bianca Tylek from the group Worth Rises. And for those of you who've been following the series, Prison and Profits, that we've been doing early in the week, Mondays or Tuesdays on the show, this winter, in advance of these Tuesday night Green Space events, you know that Bianca's been coming on with us, Worth Rises Executive Director, as we follow along with the topics that they're going to do in their Tuesday night Green Space events. And it is Prisons and Profits and Prison Labor tonight in the virtual Green Space at thegreenspace.org. So hi, Bianca. Welcome back.
Hi. How are you, Brian? Great to be with you again.
And I know you put out a report about this, and your report, as does the series, as we know from the title, you know, Prisons and Profits, your report follows the money. So can you give us a sense of the range of products on the shelves that are made, at least in part, by prisoners that people may not realize when they buy them?
Sure. So I think I really enjoyed your conversation with Senator Merkley, who we've been working with at the Abolish Slavery National Network, where I serve on the core team, and Worth Rises also is engaged, working on this federal fight to bring a new amendment to the U.S. Constitution. In terms of prison labor, I think the important thing people really do need to understand is that we often think about prison labor as it relates to private sector and corporations, but that's actually not where the bulk of prison labor is happening. More than 95% of prison labor is happening for state and federal governments. And so when we think of prison labor, we have to think about really three main buckets, the smallest of which is actually private corporations that are directly using private labor. They are, to some extent, regulated by federal law. You mentioned earlier the 1979 Act that expanded the reach for private sector into the prison industry. But today, we estimate around 5,000 people are actually regulated by that act that are currently incarcerated working for private corporations. But a lot of those products, and there are a lot of jobs that are not actually captured and regulated. So that 1979 law actually only regulated products that made it into actual products that are manufactured that made it into interstate commerce, meaning that they crossed state lines. But in fact, agriculture didn't make it, is not regulated by that law, and neither are services. So as you talk about things that have made it into our home, in fact, quite a number of our agricultural products, everything from bell peppers and onions, tomatoes, like are arriving here from farms in on prisons. And that, I think, it was even exacerbated during the last administration, because one thing that people may not be aware of is that it's estimated that as much as 70% of farming labor is actually undocumented. And when zero tolerance was announced, a lot of those farms turned to prisons to meet the gap in labor. And so agriculture is another piece that's not really tracked, but is definitely making its way into private sector and services, things like call centers. There are, if you saw during the race for the presidency, Mike Bloomberg made big headlines for using campaign calling services that actually were like campaign calls that were being made out of a prison. So those type of services are also not captured by that legislation. But quickly, the two others and the much bigger aspects are there are corporations run by state and federal governments. The federal corporation is called Unicor in New York, for example. The state corporation is called CoreCraft. And those corporations, which again are state-run corporations, mm-hmm. are actually manufacturing products for other state agencies. For example, the Department of Motor Vehicles or Department of Transportation. And in fact, in New York, most of our street signs, most of the things in the MTA, subway stations in New York City are actually made through prison labor inside of our prisons and jails. And so those kind of products that you're actually interacting with, every single license plate in the state of New York and most across the country are made by people who are incarcerated. And so that is a really big piece of the puzzle of things that are making into your home. And then, as I said, the very last thing and the largest bucket are those that are simply all of their work is maintaining the carceral structure. So those are the janitors. Those are folks who are working in the kitchen and the cooks. Those are laundry services. All of those different services that are operating inside of facilities are also part of the prison labor infrastructure.
Let's take a phone call. Here's Donald in Yonkers, who says he helped to train prison laborers to work at a supermarket. Hi, Donald. You're on WNYC, and do I have that right?
Yes, right. Yes, Brian. I worked for AMP years ago, and they had a program where they would take people from different prisons in New York State who were, you know, had a good record and let them out early, and they would come to come to work. They found, I guess they found a shelter for them and all, but they would work, and the job was paid half their salary by the state and half by the company. And I was a department manager of deli and bakeries. And I would train these people on not just the job had to have a future, not just collecting carriages or a clerk or something, stocking shelves. And they did pretty good. I taught them how to do scheduling and ordering and rules of the company. And a couple of them went to the meetings with me. Department managers have meetings like once a month. And they, I had five people over about 2 years. And I trained them, and they, two of them are still working for Acme now, because a lot of the A&B stores are Acme now.
Right. Donald, thank you very much for that story. So that's a relative success story, as Donald sees it, from the point of view of somebody who trained some prison some prisoners, you know, to work in A&P supermarkets, and he says they, you know, it helped prepare them for the workforce when they got out. How do you feel about that, Bianca? And do you think that that's a model that should continue to be used in the right ways?
Yeah, well, to clarify, that's not, he wasn't actually training people who were incarcerated. What Donald said was that he trained people who were released. And that were found, like, who were presumably in some kind of parole situation and were maybe living in some kind of transitional housing. I heard him say they found them housing. So that, I think that's different. That's like reentry services and reentry work. It's really different when we're talking about people who are like actively incarcerated. But I mean, I think the spirit of your question, right, Brian, which came up earlier, which is like, do folks inside want to work, and you know, what are those sort of sentiments? I think, you know, there's no doubt that people want to feel empowered by, you know, what they can do on a day-to-day. I think the notion that anyone's vying for current jobs inside is just not, you know, really accurate, because it's misinformed by the fact that there is an incredible amount of deprivation inside. So, you know, having people fighting over jobs that pay 60 cents an hour is wildly dehumanizing. And I think the only reason anyone is really, you know, competing for those jobs is because that's the only option. You know, at the end of the day, those like are the only options. And so I always, you know, tell people when they, you know, make comments about like things being people choosing and things being better, it's like, would people have chosen Jim Crow over slavery? Sure. Does that mean that's where we should be landing? No. So, you know, I think what exists currently in our facilities across this country is not equitable. It's not fair. It's not just. It's not humane. It's not dignified work in any way. And, you know, those are the things that we're trying to change in through our work. And by, you know, abolishing the exception to the 13th Amendment that allows for forced labor.
Bianca Tylek, Executive Director of Worth Rises. More at thegreenspace.org tonight.
Yes.
What time?
At 7 o'clock. It'll be great. We have some really awesome panelists coming.
Punishment and Profit, Tuesday nights in the Green Space through the beginning of May, and weekly on this show, previewing each episode. Thanks for coming on, as always.
Thank you so much, Brian. Take care.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.